Welcome to the Molding Private Practice Show, where we help healthcare practitioners in private practice keep true to their purpose and build a life of mastery by providing the knowledge, skills, and tools to bring their dreams to life. In this episode of the show, we speak to Precious Ramasoli about being a clinical psychologist and everything private practice management related. Precious Ramasoli, welcome to the show. So we're so glad to have you on board and talking about being a clinical psychologist and private practice and all of that great stuff. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure, and really interested to hear your story and, you know, how you currently set up in private practice and that stuff. But I always like to ask this question is, when you're growing up, you know, people always ask you, I don't know if that's cultural as well, but people always ask you, what do you want to do when you grow up? So for us, it was like, you know, you're going to be a doctor, lawyer, accountant or something like that. Did you get that question firstly? And did the young Precious say she wanted to be a clinical psychologist?
You know, Oliver, I think with all throughout school, my career aspirations kept changing. So it's strange to me as well when I think of how I ended up in as a therapist. It kept changing. But I think towards the end of high school, with all of the aptitude tests, and I think they'd probably brought, we had a careers day and had sort of different professionals come and speak about, or university representatives come and speak about the different faculties and what they offer. For myself, it sort of narrowed down to something in humanities, because I could tell from the aptitude tests and just from my own assessment of myself, working with people and helping people was a big thing for me. So anything social work would have been an option, psychology, anything that would have resulted in me working with people. I think a big thing for any therapist, right, for all therapists, is there must be a passion for people. And then secondly, an analytical mind, trying to make sense of stuff and always search for deeper meaning and understanding. So those two qualities, I think, are, I'd say all therapists probably definitely have those two qualities, actually. So for me, my career aspirations definitely kept changing. But it narrowed down to something in the humanities. And then even after a lot of discouragement, I got a bit of discouragement from parents and a few other people that were saying, this is actually quite hard to get all the way through to master's level. But somehow there was this determination in me that I thought, well, I could do that. It's not too bad. I'm sure I could make it. And then I was accepted into the program as well for undergrad and then postgrad.
And what would some of those choices, the alternatives have been? I'm always interested to know, just so that, I mean, like, we paint the picture for if someone wants to, I mean, I've had some interesting, like, responses. You know, the one practitioner said she wanted to be a rugby player. The other one was like a trapeze artist. And the reason I asked that question is, like, you know, if you're listening to this and, you know, if you have this inkling that I want to be a dancer, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're never, ever going to become a clinical psychologist. Mm-hmm. It's just maybe that phase in life that you're in now or whatever that is.
For a long while, I really wanted to be an interior designer. So that's still a big passion and interest of mine. So I like beautiful spaces and just the feel you get from how you move around furniture and the orientation in a room. So that was a big passion of mine. But unfortunately, I didn't have parents that thought that that would be a sustainable career. So I could not go for that. And then also, I think with the options that did come up, something where there would be order, structure, but with the aspect of working with people. So as opposed to just being a librarian where you can organize books and have systems for keeping information and you know, systems for how you organize your library and working according to order, right? There was the aspect of also wanting to organize information, but for people. So interacting with people and connecting with people was a big thing for me. But creating coherence and a sense of meaning in their world. Yeah, I think that's how I ended up with this profession. I think this, interior design would have just led me to organize a space in such a way that it feels calm or peaceful or serene for a person, and their individual style is represented there. Working with books or any sort of system or technology would have helped me feel in control and orderly, and that I'm mastering a system. But this profession enables me to connect with people while mastering information about them, right? And helping them feel a sense of mastery over their lives as well. So I think that was the perfect mix with this profession for me.
Yeah, I get even more enamored with asking that question, you know, and hearing the responses. And, you know, when you said that, firstly, I have a lot of respect for people that have an inclination towards interior design, because I haven't the faintest clue how that works. And I just don't have that in me. I'm more like, you know, I'm kind of satisfied with what we have kind of thing. But when you see, you know, it's like art or paintings. When you see good art, and even music is a good example too. You know when you're listening to something that's good, you know, like, and I'm like a audiophile, mm-hmm. you know, that is, you know, when you listen to like a good mm-hmm. record, you know, or LP, and you can hear it on a good mm-hmm. sound system, you know it's good. You know, like if you hear mm-hmm. good, like, you know, singer or artist.
True.
The same thing with space as well. When you come into a house and you see that space, you just know it's good. But it might not be for everyone. Yeah.
So true, yeah. It doesn't take training to recognize a beautifully composed song. You don't have to be trained, or you just feel that it's just a beautiful track next to you somehow. True.
When you said that as well, so I'm thinking interior designer and how you're designing, you know, people's lives at the moment to be like decluttered and, you know, having those open spaces, you know, following up from our Molding Health episode, you know, that we had on depression, and how convoluted and intermingled that, you know, that whole thing can become, that you don't almost like leave space for yourself, you know, to that whole self-love and that aspect. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think it's really nice when you can sort of make sense for a person, put your finger on, this is actually why you feel this way. Yes, there's a little bit of stress at work, but it's always been there and you've been fine with it. Yes, you know, you come from a big family, you know how to manage people well, but what's really actually causing this, if we can put our finger on it, it's not all these other big things that have always been there. Once identifying what really is the cause of their distress is so, what's the word? It illuminates a whole lot. Everything falls into place and they can see, this is it. It's not that I'm stressed at work. I've always been stressed at work, and the pressure actually gets me going. It's not that we are, you know, I have a new child. I've come from a big family. I know how to manage each person well, and manage my relationships well. It's this aspect. It's this one aspect of what's happened with this friend. This breakdown in this relationship feels, there's a sense of rejection from that, or not being able to process the breakdown in that relationship. That's what's actually bothering them. Identifying that and helping a person work through that is, it's actually a privilege to get to assist people in that way. It really is. When they can't make sense of what's happening. It seems like it could be a whole variety of things, but when you can put your finger on it and they can also process those feelings, it's a joy to be able to help people do that.
Mm. I think you articulated really well. And I want to come back to that point a little bit just now, but I didn't ask you, and I do want to ask this in your own words, what does a clinical psychologist do?
All right. So clinical psychologists, it's, you know, with the HPCSA, there's 5 different categories, or I think it might be 6 now. There's clinical, counseling, research, industrial, educational, and neuropsychologist. And how the HPCSA explains what a clinical psychologist does is we would work specifically with mental disorders or severe pathology. So although we all sort of trained quite similarly, not all universities separate the clinicals from the counselings. Some do, and the training is very specific for each category. Often we have a lot of, we've been trained in the same way, right? And we have the same knowledge and level of skill. What the difference with the clinical psychologist is they are trained specifically or more would be better able, let me not say that, actually a clinical or a counseling or educational would also be able to very well identify a disorder. What we're focused on is on mental disorders that require hospitalization, right? So working in a hospital setting with an MDT and with severe pathology. So when a person is no longer functioning because of their anxiety, because of whether it be brain trauma, a brain injury, whatever it might be, whatever's caused the problem, we are trained to work with severe pathology. Counseling psychologists are also quite skilled. They have a lot, again, the training is often quite very much the same. Your educational would focus more on working in a child setting, with children, so with families or in schools, with learning disorders or neurodevelopmental problems. And then you get your industrial psychologists who would focus more on the work setting and on improving a person's behavior and adapting to a work context.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Mm. Thanks very much for breaking that down and I think pointing out the similarities and obviously, you know, differences mm-hmm. in the different, types of psychologists, especially. The point I want to make with what you said previously as well is that I think it's the one discipline, and I think there's a few, obviously, and healthcare practitioners in general, I have a huge amount of respect for. But I think with psychologists, it's actually a misnomer that you're just talking to someone, and it's a lot mm-hmm. of problem solving. It's a very science-based, you know, profession. And I think people miss mm-hmm. that part as well, that you're actually solving, mm-hmm. like, you know, problems at the highest level because you're solving them with people. You know, it's not a pure maths-based equation. And I think that's the part that they miss. And I've had a lot more of a respect, you know, after speaking to many, many psychologists, you know, on the shows, is mm-hmm. how scientific and how science-based that is. You know, because people normally think psychology, you have to go through a BA, but it's actually a BSc as well, you know, that you're going through. And I think the psychology itself, you know, as a subject and as a discipline is definitely that's problem solving aspect. Mm-hmm. Do you find that mm-hmm. as well? Did you know that when you were getting into it?
I think I just thought of it as talking. I had a very simplistic view of it, but there is a lot of, there's a lot of science to it. Specifically with the clinical psychology and with working with severe pathology, there's all sorts of medical considerations, like even with depression, right? So it's, you have to make sure that also medically there's no other reason for why the person would be experiencing these symptoms. So it's not due to Parkinson's disease, for example, or not a medication that they're taking. The MDT is all part of assisting and making sure that you're helping this person deal with their problem. I guess there is an aspect of it being, so there's the skill set, right? There's a lot of research that goes into it. There's a lot of clinical-based evidence for the work that we do. And then there is the skill to be able to do it the right way. So that maybe I'd say is more of the art to it as opposed to the science. Because we can all read through the manuals and the textbooks, but there's an art to how you interact with the person and how you make them feel safe and to connect with you. And sometimes that doesn't always work, right? And that's actually fine, because there's a therapist for every person. And sometimes people try several different therapists before finding a therapist that they would settle with and stay with long term, and that they'd keep going back to anytime that any life change occurs, and they would like to get back and sit with someone and just talk about what's happening. So they're also connecting to you as a person, right? So yes, you have your clinical knowledge, you're a clinician, you're trained to diagnose these disorders, you know about all of the research evidence that's there. But then there's you and their level of trust in you, that you seem to, they have confidence in you as a person, right? Because they do feel comfortable with you. They can trust you. You are responding in a way that feels sensitive for them. It doesn't feel like you're just giving them a generic answer that you gave to your last patient. So there's also that aspect as well. Yeah. And that's what usually makes, and that's actually what works, right? There's research for this. That's actually what works. There's a study, but I can't now recall the exact specifics of it. But the study was sort of looking at across types, different types of therapy, and CBT therapists versus a psychodynamic orientated therapist versus a person-centered versus whoever it might be. What are the specific things that they're doing that are actually working? There is an art to it, and there is things, aspects about the person and them, your patient being able to feel comfortable and safe with you, that also adds to successful therapy.
Okay. If you ever do find it, I would love for you to send it. I mean, I think it would be an amazing resource, because we have covered many of the modalities, you know, within the show, within the Molding Health show anyway. You know, around like CBT, you know, psychodynamic, contextual therapy, and stuff like that. Hypnotherapy we covered as well. So yeah, different aspects to it. But love to get that. I think it would be amazing. Sure, amazing as a resource.
I'll find that to just send. Yeah, if I can just find it, I'll send that to you.
Okay. And Precious, coming back to the studying part. So from the time someone convinced you, actually you need to do, you know, or you convinced yourself, it seems, you know, around becoming a clinical psychologist or maybe even just a psychologist, to the time that you got your HPCSA number or your registration, was that an easy process?
It was a strenuous process. It was not so easy. I was fortunate to get into master's directly after. I don't know, maybe it might have been a blessing and a curse, directly after undergrad. So I finished my honors and I did my B-Psych, so which is 4 years in honors equivalent. And then it has an internship component, which is just for 6 months. And then got right into master's directly after that. So without a lot of work experience at all, just 6 months work experience, started my master's and the sixth year. The fifth year is focused mainly on your academics, mainly on just modules, coursework. And then there might be a bit of, work that your M1s will do with patients already. So they'll already start seeing patients, child clients, and adult clients. And then your sixth year is your internship year. So that's your internship year. And then seventh year would be your community service year. So it's quite a lot. It is a lot. It's academically demanding. There's a lot that you have to learn in a short space of time, right? There's a lot you have to sort of, and it sort of comes together in that fifth and sixth year. In your undergrad year, it feels like there's a whole lot of different modules and coursework that you're completing without it fitting together cohesively, at least for me. Let me give my personal reflection. It feels that you're just sort of completing all of these different courses, and modules. And then when you actually start working with people, then it all, oh, this is why we had to learn about such and such a theorist, or all of that comes together in your fifth and sixth year. It's academically demanding. There's research, which is a whole huge thing, which it takes up a lot of time. But if you're quite focused, people are able to get it done well and efficiently within the right amount of time. It was a difficult process, but I got through it. So I think a lot of people can get through it. Yeah.
I think you have one of the more successful stories, actually, from what I've heard, because most people do struggle to get into that master's program. And I think there would be quite a few envious people because I know people that have tried like, you know, two or three times, actually by their own confessions and the episodes. But yeah, I think well done for doing that. And I do want to say 7 years. And, you know, for anyone listening to it and wants to become a psychologist, 7 years is, I mean, a long time. 7 years is, you know, probably your doctor or medicine type professions. You know, so it's not a trivial path that you go through. Would you agree with that statement?
It's not. It really is. It's quite tough. But I don't know. I managed to get through somehow on the first try. So I feel like at the same time, there is something about it that is quite doable. You know, I think there's specific aspects that the board, whatever the university or the panel of interviewers that's making selections for masters, there's specific things they're looking for, which are qualities that people possess. So just being caring, being caring, being academically inclined, right? So if you went through your undergrad and you don't have to get distinctions for every single thing, but just good enough performance, maybe you've done a bit of volunteer work, maybe. So they're looking for a level of emotional maturity. They're looking for a level of passion for people. They're looking for to see academic ability as well. When I think of my story, I think I am among few that get picked the first time, but I really think it was a bit of a, made it more difficult for me. I wish I'd had a little bit more work experience and more actual experience being out in the world with people, because I went straight from high school to undergrad into master's. And then you're out in the big wide world and people expect you to have all this knowledge about the human experience and what it's like to go through life. And you're 24, 25, and people are coming to you with their huge life challenges, and you've just been through school the whole time. So I think there is an element of going through life that prepares you for the problems that people will bring to you. Right? So just experiencing all sorts of things before you want to sit in a chair and guide someone else through their problems.
I think the term that comes to mind now is the one that I've heard so many times, which is imposter syndrome. But yeah, I hear you. And I think you said something. I was going to ask you, like, do you have any advice in terms of, you know, the board? And I think you summarized that perfectly as well without me asking it. The thing that I've heard come up, because you said emotional maturity, I think that's a really good term to describe it. But, you know, people have suggested that, you know, maybe doing volunteering, also maybe being in your own therapy, you know, so that you show that you are taking your own, you know, mental health and self-development seriously, because I think that seems to have helped around convincing, you know, the board that you are emotionally mature. I think the work experience, I can kind of see how, you know, having experience in a work setting, you know, would give you another level of maturity and, you know, dimension, you know, that you're showing them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And by virtue of that, you didn't mention community service, or did you? But going into community service, was that a good experience?
Yes, it was. So I did community service in the Northwest at Klerksdorp Hospital, Klerksdorp Tsepong Hospital Complex. I found that to be just a good experience. Again, it was so working with people who are severely ill, who need to be admitted, we do intake interviews with them. We call it the psychiatric interview. You might do that interview several times before you can keep gauging the person's improvement over the period that they're in the hospital. Doing ongoing therapy with outpatients, so people who've been discharged but have chronic conditions like schizophrenia and depression, and they keep coming to collect medication, but they also will need just the supportive element to maintain their progress. They come in for therapy as outpatients every now and then. So with community service, actually most hospitals will allow you to continue with community outreaches. So in your internship year, that's actually compulsory that an intern does something, an outreach program or initiative, wherever they are based for internship. And in community service, often hospitals do have programs such as those. So you'll do, maybe it's a talk for childcare workers at a ECD center, whatever the need is in your community, you identify something and see how you can help and intervene. So ComServe was good for me. I enjoyed that different setting because I'd studied in Port Elizabeth, now the Becher. So I'd studied there and it just gave me a chance to use my skill with a different demographic, you know, in a different location with different people.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, nice. Different parts of the world as well from there. I know we're going to run out of time soon, but I do want to ask you around private practice as well, quickly. But mm-hmm. private practice itself, was that a difficult move getting into that? And any words of wisdom that you would give someone, you know, that wants to start up their own private practice?
I will say, I think it can be a bit daunting because although there is some orientation that they give you in your master's year about how private practice works, there is some orientation I think it's compulsory. There's a business module that's compulsory in undergrad. And then you might get a bit of guidance from university lecturers on their private practices. But it can be quite a daunting task starting up your own private practice. I was fortunate, so I got to just speak to a well-established practitioner who just advised on some of the business aspects of it. So setting up a business account, registering an actual company, which is your practice, as opposed to just operating and having medical aides, for example, pay you into your personal account. So just sort of legitimizing it as a business. All of the admin with registering with medical aides and all of that paperwork and making sure your practice is registered. So there's all of that, which once you've done that, at least that's done, as opposed to, and sometimes you hear of new medical aides because there's so many. So sometimes a patient will come in through your door and they're registered with a very small medical aid, but then again, you just send through your paperwork to them and you're registered and you can claim from them. So those are the big things. I think setting up the practice, finding the right location, getting all your letterheads and in forms, right? Made all your own forms put together, organizing your filing system for how you want to organize your patient files. And then I guess because it is a business, all the marketing aspects, making sure that it's in a good location. People can find you on the internet if they're looking for a therapist. So just making sure that you're visible and that you have a footprint digitally. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, sounds amazing. And I just want to say it's quite complicated, and I think listen to that. I think you said a lot in a few minutes, which we can unpack, in further detail. But I mean, it is. But I think you covered all of the really amazing parts, including the medical aid stuff, which I thought was amazing. To wrap up, any advice that you would give to anyone listening to this, and they heard your story and they said, I really love, what Krisha said around being a clinical psychologist or going to private practice?
I'd say my advice is just to get started. I think we always because we can get overwhelmed with thinking of how the end product should look, that anxiety is often what holds people back. So just getting started. If people would first like to locum as a psychologist under another psychologist and see how a psychologist practices run, that's a good idea. Often people do that straight out of varsity, work under another therapist until they feel confident enough to start their own business. I think just get started. With regards to the training, I'd say best part, or what really helps a person stand out with regards to master selection, is having done volunteer work. So having done volunteer work, having done your own therapy, like you mentioned, those are the two aspects. And then good enough academic performance. So don't have to have distinctions for everything, but just good academic performance, interest in working with people and helping people, and then your own, because there is no perfect person, your own attempt to understand yourself in therapy and work through any of your own emotional stuff, whatever that might be.
Yeah. Thanks so much. That summarizes it perfectly. Thanks for all of that guidance. I think it was absolutely amazing hearing you say that. Thanks so much for what you do. Thanks for agreeing to be on the show. It was absolutely amazing speaking to you.
Thank you, Oliver. Thank you for letting me share about the work that I do. Hopefully this will be helpful to a few people.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening. As always, stay tuned and we'll speak to you in the next episode.